ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, this is Rear Vision. I'm Jen Leake. Australia is experiencing a spike in the number of people dying on our roads. It's particularly bad in New South Wales and Victoria, but all states have seen increases.
It's the third crash involving four or more fatalities in the northeast of the state this year, and police say it's added to a disturbing spike nationally that must be addressed.
The NRMA has described the state's road toll as catastrophic and says it's in the midst of a road safety crisis.
We've seen 253 people die in New South Wales alone. Across the country, it's just as bad, if not worse. We've seen, as of the end of July, 721 Australian deaths on Australian roads across the whole country, up 7%.
Australia pioneered road safety. Victoria was the first place in the world to make seatbelts mandatory. And along with New South Wales, they also led the way with random breath testing. So how did we manage to introduce measures that were years ahead of other countries? And why, after decades of consistent improvements, has our progress stalled? In the late 1960s, road trauma was reaching epidemic proportions. It was a time before seatbelts, before speed cameras, and drink driving went virtually unchecked. In 1970, the worst year on record, 3,798 people lost their lives. That's more than 10 deaths a day. And of course, at the time, our population was a lot smaller. The push for better road safety came from a sector of society working on the front line, trauma surgeons who were witnessing the devastation coming into hospitals. They began to lobby for seatbelts and to bring awareness around the dangers of drink driving. It was led by the Australasian College of Surgeons based in Victoria.
The first, if you like, commitment by surgeons to prevention of injury was the establishment of a road trauma committee. And that was cognizant of the extreme numbers of Australians being killed on roads at that stage, the desire to have science underpin and support effective policy development.
Dr. John Crozier is a former head of the National Trauma Committee at the college. And as a young medical student, he treated road trauma victims before seatbelts and drink driving laws were widespread.
We would be allowed as third or fourth year undergraduates to work in the emergency department, and the burden of alcohol affected either drivers or frequently it was occupants of vehicles, where in the absence of effective drink driving legislation and seatbelts, there were horrific facial injuries. They would take hours to clean and suture. And there was such a burden of that sort of work that it was often delegated to medical students under supervision.
The work done by the college and doctors to educate the public was critical, and it was also a cause the state government was happy to get behind. Another factor, Victoria's police surgeon, Dr. John Birrell, was a passionate advocate for road safety. Here he is talking about the dangers of drink driving in the 1970s before random testing was introduced.
The community is bloody ignorant of the results of alcohol and driving, and the result of that ignorance is blood, and blood on the highway. So many young people are being killed and injured, and this applies not only to the males, but the females, unfortunately, are commonly in what we call the hot or suicide seat, and the girls go through the windscreen.
There was resistance from the public. People were scared of seatbelts. They were worried if they had a car crash, the seatbelt would trap them in the vehicle. And taxi drivers, for example, also campaigned against the idea. They were concerned wearing a seatbelt would prevent them from comfortably changing the car radio. But mandatory seatbelts became law in Victoria in 1971. By 1972, every Australian state made wearing seatbelts in the front seat compulsory. It was a slow start. It only applied to cars that were a few years old, and children under 8 were initially exempt.
How can you restrain kids in the parcel part of a station wagon, the classic place for kids to sit?
Mark King is adjunct professor at the Centre for Accident Research and Road Safety at QUT. In 1980, Mark joined the Federal Office of Road Safety in Victoria, almost 10 years after seatbelts were introduced.
One of the first things that you were asked to do as somebody new was to do seatbelt counts, so to go out to a busy intersection somewhere and stand on the median with your clipboard, and of course it's all low-tech, so clipboard, a pencil, and see whether people were wearing their seatbelts.
How do you think compliance was 10 years after?
It had been pretty good. There were some entrenched pockets of resistance, and there were, I guess, get-out clauses, so that if you had a car that had been manufactured before a certain date, you didn't have to have seatbelts in it. And, for example, my father held on to his older car because he was convinced that he would be more at risk if he was wearing seatbelts. In the trucking industry, for many years after that time, there was also a widely shared belief that if your truck started to roll over, the best thing you could do was to hold onto the steering wheel and go with it and not be belted in. There was a lot of trouble taken to try and address that particular spurious belief.
Seatbelts were one thing, but the road to widespread random breath testing took a lot longer.
Alcohol has long been isolated as the single biggest factor in accidents causing death and injury. Now the government wants West Australians to consider whether they want random breath testing of drivers. It's an extreme measure, but one which might keep drunk drivers off the road. You don't feel it would be an intrusion on your civil rights if a policeman stopped you?
To a certain extent, yes, I do. I don't know how to put it, actually, but I think it's developing into a bit of a police state, this place.
Why should we stop? You know, general social behaviour of the motorist. He's used to, I think it's the Australian habit, he's used to for years going out drinking of a night time and driving. And it's something, you know, we've got to educate. I think education comes in a lot too. We've got to educate these people that they shouldn't, you know, drive when they've been drinking too much.
Well, it is a disease, and it responds, I think, to measures just the same as any other disease. For example, the difference in the Victorian road crash victim situation with seatbelts has been quite extraordinary.
As early as 1968, laws were passed in New South Wales making it compulsory for drivers suspected of being under the influence of alcohol to take a breath test. But operations were limited and the technology was basic. Glenn Weir is Assistant Commissioner for Road Policing Command with Victoria Police.
The technology that was used was very cumbersome. It didn't allow for sort of mass testing. You had the old blow in the bag that people remember. And I remember when I graduated, that's how you were trained it was a glass cylinder that you put into a bag, got someone to blow into it through these crystals, and, you know, the crystals would change colour and that gave you an indication that they were over, and you would then, with a properly trained person from the police, would give them a breath test using a breathalyzer back at the police station.
Random breath testing got through in Victoria in 1976, but the idea stirred fierce debate around the country as other states tested the concept. Pubs and clubs campaigned heavily against, convinced they'd be forced to shut their doors. Terry Slevin is CEO of the Public Health Association of Australia.
So firstly, the argument is it's anti-business. So we would hear of all the mum and dad pubs in country, state whatever state you're in, going to close because of these draconian nanny state laws. Of course, you're competent people that can drive home even if you had a glass of wine or two with dinner, and this is just a civilized society, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, all of that stuff played out. In the early days, you know, there was very significant resource invested by the alcohol sector, not just the retailers, pubs and clubs, but also the manufacturers, the brewers and the distillers. Mm. to seek to undermine, challenge, push back, and depict as overly controlling nanny statism, the kind of things we now accept as sensible and normal. Mm. So it takes a while for that cultural change to shift, and it takes investment of time and effort and energy.
In 1982, the New South Wales Australian Hotels Association president described RBT as an imposition on the working class, an unfair attack on responsible, sane drinking drivers who pose absolutely no danger on the road. But in that same year, New South Wales started a three-year trial. They called it Boots and All. The strategy was to make random breath testing much more consistent and visible. And they used jingles like this one to help spread the message. How will you go when you sit for the test? How will you go when you sit for the test? Will you be under 05 or under arrest? How will you go? Other states move slower than Victoria and New South Wales, but by the early 90s, random breath testing with a BAC limit of 0.05 was standard across the country. This is Rear Vision. I'm Jen Leake. Police enforce our road rules, but they also get exposed to the devastation of road trauma in a way many of us don't. Glenn Weir is Assistant Commissioner for Road Policing Command with Victoria Police. In the 1980s, as a young police officer working in the outer suburbs of Melbourne, he attended a crash where four women died.
They'd been at a soccer match and their husbands were in a car in front of them, four of them, and the four ladies were following along behind them, and there was an animal on the road and the husbands in front had sort of swerved to miss it and then gone back on the right side of the road, but the ladies driving behind had seen them go on the other side of the road and for whatever reason went on the other side of the road as well and kept going and got hit by a truck coming the other way, and they were all killed instantly. And just the to have that with four women killed and their four husbands being there and then the rest, other people from that soccer club coming along the road or going home after being in a functional day, and just the grief, guilt that they all felt, and trying to manage that scene, trying to, you know, establish a large scene, a high-speed impact, a truck driver going the other way who'd just done nothing wrong. And an unfortunate set of circumstances where a really split-second mistake cost the lives of four people. That's something, and that palpable grief that those four guys were feeling at the scene was something that I won't forget.
New South Wales and Victoria, two states that have led the way with road safety and usually have the lowest fatalities per head of population, have both seen a rise in road deaths.
New South Wales has had a horror year this year. Their lives lost more than 50 above what it was last year. We're just under 40 above where we were last year. So we've had a really strange set of incidents in Victoria this year. So this time last year, we'd had two double fatalities in Victoria, four people killed in two fatalities. We hadn't had any triple fatalities or anything higher. This year we've had 10 double fatalities, we've had two quadruple fatalities, and we've had a terrible collision up near Wangaratta where five people were killed. That's really unusual.
And more people are not wearing seatbelts.
And for some strange reason, we're seeing a bit of a back to the future. We've got a significant number of people now not wearing seatbelts involved in road trauma, even though most cars, modern cars now, sort of yell at you in an audible tone if you haven't got your seatbelt on. So we've got people deliberately trying to avoid wearing a properly fitted adjusted seatbelt, and the new cameras that were designed for mobile phones but also seatbelts are catching a large number of those people. It's quite concerning.
What's your thoughts on that? Any idea why we might be seeing people turning away from seatbelts?
A couple of reasons. Like I've been doing this 42 years, people are weird. They do some really weird things. You see something that happens or an event of trauma that, and you go, why on earth would someone do that? And that human behaviour and our ability to sort of moderate or change human behaviour to avoid risk is a constant challenge. I think some people, there is a, and we've lost our a bit of patience. We've lost some manners as a society and certainly as road users. And we've got, I think there's a bit of inbuilt arrogance that seems to be prevalent in a lot of people that, you know, whether it's a reaction to lockdowns and COVID restrictions, I don't know, but there's a lot of people who seem to be deliberately giving the middle finger to common sense.
Australia's roads are safe by international standards. Compare our approach to the United States, for example, and it's quite shocking how far behind they are. David Cliff is a former police officer and now CEO of the Global Road Safety Partnership.
The trauma levels in the United States at a national level are extraordinarily high. I think they've got the highest rates of death per 100,000 population of any high-income country. A few reasons for that. You're right, the vehicle fleet, a lot of these very large SUVs do horrendous damage to pedestrians and cyclists. There's no random breath testing, so the ability to stop and test is just not there. It's not legally sanctioned. They've got a very high drink drive limit of 0.08, which compares with the 0.05 limit for the general population in Australia. And there isn't that focus of road policing that exists in, you know, places like Victoria and New South Wales, etc. So, yeah, and as a consequence, there are huge numbers that are killed needlessly in the United States.
There's an aspect to road safety which is much harder to influence, and that's how we view the risk when it comes to driving a car.
When we get behind the wheel of a car, we perceive it to be safe. We don't get jittery and worried about the chances of us being killed or seriously injured. And I counter that with most people when they get in an aircraft think that, oh, what happens if it crashes? And they probably have that as a passing thought. Whereas we know the aviation industry is dramatically safer than driving in a car. So we as drivers don't perceive risk. So we still see people don't understand that travelling over speed limits dramatically increases the chances that they or their passengers could be killed or seriously injured. People don't understand that not wearing a safety belt, regardless of where, you know, an urban street or a highway, is critical to protect you from serious injuries in a collision. The same thing even with drink driving. While that issue has been front and centre for well over a generation, police are still catching people who are driving after drinking alcohol. So the risks associated with these things are just not understood. The basic thinking is of most drivers is it won't happen to me. And sadly, because of the volume of deaths and serious injuries, we know that it does happen to quite a significant number of people every single year.
Sweden is the world leader in road safety, and they developed a concept called safe systems. It has four components. Number one, safe speeds.
Setting speed limits that are consistent with the use of the road. So, for example, in urban areas where there's a lot of pedestrian and cycle traffic, speed limits should not be more than 30 kilometres per hour. In non-divided rural roads where vehicles can run off the road and hit a roadside object or have a head-on collision, speed limits there should not be more than 80 kilometres an hour. And on expressways, motorways, no more than 100 kilometres an hour. So those are some examples of what safe speeds look like.
Number two is safe vehicles, introducing more rigorous minimum safety standards and discouraging the use of SUVs.
The nature of the fleet. So, for example, high proportions of these very large, heavy SUVs are incredibly dangerous for pedestrians and cyclists. So those sorts of changes in the fleet can really make a difference to trauma rates.
Number three is safer roads and safer design, introducing barriers and median divisions on rural roads and in urban areas, things like better bike lanes and roundabouts.
And then lastly, safe road users. And that's really where policing does an enormously important job. So making sure people are wearing safety belts, wearing helmets, keeping to safe speeds, not driving after drinking alcohol. So when all of those parts of the system operate in concert, that's when the greatest reductions occur. But you can't just focus on one of them. You need to focus on all of them. It would be fair to say that no one anywhere in the world has done everything correctly. So even while Australia's made fantastic gains, the speed limits on many of the rural non-divided roads are still way too high.
It would be so hard to try and change those speed limits, though, don't you think?
It's a real challenge. People don't understand the risk of travelling, for example, at 100 kilometres an hour on a non-divided rural road. A good example of what can be done is our neighbours, where we are here in France, reduced their non-divided rural part of the network from 90, which was the speed limit, down to 80. And in the 18 months after they did that, they reduced the number of deaths by over 330 on that part of the network. So France did it. It was very unpopular with the driving population, but they did it and they achieved huge reductions in death.
Australia has a challenge that many European countries don't. We have a massive network of rural roads.
One of the issues that Australia has is that if you look at where fatalities occur, at least half of our fatalities are occurring on high-speed roads. And we have a lot of high-speed roads because we're a big country. So that makes it harder. So if you look at the best performers, there are European countries where you have a much more limited amount of high-speed roads. You still have quite a bit of high-speed traffic, though, in those countries. I think the other issue is, by comparison, those countries in Europe are able to invest more per kilometre in the work that they do to make roads safe because they have less kilometres of road, a greater population concentration. We still also have a lot of substandard roads out in the rural areas, and it's really hard to both to upgrade them and to maintain that. When you look at the climate change events that we're having, the massive floods and things like that, that just destroys so much infrastructure, and the cost of getting that back in place is hard.
And road safety is not just about cars and drivers. It's pedestrians, cyclists, people riding e-scooters. Ingrid Johnson is from the Australasian College of Road Safety.
We talk about road safety and people automatically think cars when you say road, and they wonder if footpaths and bike paths might be included in that. And really they have to be, because road safety is about everyone being able to get where they need to go from A to B safely. If you are travelling on a country road, then if you crash as a driver, you're more likely to die. Fatalities are way overrepresented on country roads, but serious injuries are way overrepresented in built-up urban areas. And that's where you have the mix of vehicles with pedestrians and cyclists and e-scooters becoming such an issue. That's where that is showing itself.
Lower speeds across the board can make a big difference. Countries like Sweden have reduced speed limits in built-up areas down to 30 k's.
Very small reductions in the speeds of the whole population. So when everybody slows down by just a few kilometres an hour, that makes a massive difference to the trauma levels. So the volume of people who are being killed, seriously injured, entering the hospital systems, those things are directly related to how fast the population is travelling. And I don't think people generally understand that speed is really one of the most critical issues in terms of reducing the trauma levels that are occurring. Another one is just targeting high speeds. So, for example, if police just focus on drivers travelling at, for example, 10 or more kilometres an hour over a speed limit, that's the wrong approach. Low-end speeding needs to be focused on just as much as high-end speeding. So having low enforcement threshold, so not allowing drivers to travel significantly above speed limits, so no more than 3 or 4 kilometres an hour before enforcement takes place, that's so effective.
Probably one of the biggest changes in how we drive is mobile phones. Russell White is from the Australian Road Safety Foundation.
Not everybody will drink drive. Not everybody will break the speed limit. But everybody, regardless of how you're using the road, will have a mobile phone either in their hand, in their pocket, or be using it in some way. And we just haven't really covered the distraction piece anywhere near as we should. I mean, a good example, Jennifer, is the view that, you know, if you're using a hands-free phone, if you've got it in a cradle and you're using it, then that's taken the risk away. And that's not true. There's plenty of scientific evidence that says the level of distraction using a phone hands-free or hands-held is exactly the same. It doesn't change. It's just legal to do it. We've got to start looking at distraction in the same way as we looked at drink driving, you know, let's say in the 80s. You know, we eventually made drink driving something that was socially unacceptable to do. And we've got to do the same thing with distraction. To me, that's the only way we're going to fix that.
Australia has had random breath testing for decades. And while society's attitudes have definitely changed, the issue still requires constant attention.
The assumption, certainly when we first started out in the drink driving area in particular, the assumption was that by using police to enforce the law and people having to conform to something which they didn't actually initially agree with, you would get a change in values. There was a lot of people who disagreed with it and said that they didn't want to comply and that it was a bad idea, but they would have to do it because they might get caught. And then after it had been in place for a while and we went out to people again, their attitudes had changed. It was like, well, no, it's fair enough and I'm going to do the right thing. So there was a sense that, oh, well, we've changed these attitudes simply by making people change their behaviour. But what we saw with the pandemic, when we had this circumstance where enforcement dropped quite significantly, our traffic dropped too. So logically, you would expect that even though enforcement dropped, you would still have a drop in fatalities. And we didn't get it, especially in Queensland. We actually had an increase. And looking since then, there's been problems with the road toll in all Australian states. And this is happening overseas as well.
What Australia has achieved in road safety is a public health success story, and anyone hopping in a car today is safer for it. But are we starting to take those gains for granted?
You know, if you look at it internationally, the things that Australia did in the enforcement area were well ahead of their time. But it's one of those situations where you really can't rest on your laurels unless you're doing new things, unless you're maintaining that focus on the things that we know work. The numbers do start to go up just through the pressure of things like population.
Is what we've done for years, cutting the mustard, or we need to do something else. We are well placed, but we shouldn't be complacent.
Road safety isn't a problem for police or government in isolation. It's actually up to each and every one of us as a road user to do our own part. And I think that's part of the challenge we face now, is how do we change the narrative from it being perceived as someone else's problem?
Russell White is from the Road Safety Foundation. Thanks also to Glenn Weir, Assistant Commissioner for Road Policing Command with Victoria Police. David Cliff is from the Global Road Safety Partnership. Ingrid Johnson is from the Australasian College of Road Safety. Mark King is an adjunct professor at the Centre for Road Safety and Accident Research at QUT. Dr. John Crozier is a former head of the National Trauma Committee at the Royal College of Australasian Surgeons. And Terry Slevin is from the Public Health Association of Australia. This Rear Vision was produced by me, Jen Leake, and sound engineer Nathan Turnbull for RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.